Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Chef Jose Andres, who joins us to discuss this week's White House Conference on Hunger, Health, and Nutrition. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Biden administration released the second of three rules to address competition in the meat and poultry sectors. The latest rule seeks to protect what USDA calls market-vulnerable producers, or anyone who may be subjected to a heightened risk of adverse treatment because of their race, gender, sexual orientation, or religious affiliation. USDA is also expected to participate in an effort to help state attorneys general better investigate and enforce competitive issues. The department is also beginning the process of awarding $500 million in grants this week to fuel domestic fertilizer production. The program was announced earlier this year and is meant to address supply chain issues keeping American farmers from getting the reliable inputs they need for their crops at an affordable price. Grants will be awarded in two separate allotments, a 45-day application window for projects that can help with the supplies for the 2023 and 2024 crop years, and a separate 90-day window for efforts needing a little more time. And finally, the Biden administration released a strategy to end hunger and boost physical activity, but they'll need some cooperation from Congress to do it. The strategy was released before the White House's Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. That event was convened to discuss ways to end hunger by 2030, but an administration official called the strategy a longer-term vision that extends beyond that point. Some of the main points include free and healthy school meals for children and developing a standardized labeling system that would make it easier for people to find foods that are part of a healthy eating pattern. Congressional Republicans voiced frustrations over the strategy this week, saying they were not included in the development of the plan. The White House is certain to need congressional action to accomplish many of its goals, something that will be much easier with bipartisan support. The afternoon keynote at the event was chef and humanitarian Jose Andres. He brought with him a message that food needs to be part of a solution, not a problem, in the hunger and nutrition conversation.
Obviously, in the very big picture, food can only be the solution because we all have to keep eating. Therefore, is many, many opportunities. Obviously, on the health front, I think it's very clear by now that sometimes the conversation needs to go around not eating the huge quantities we eat. Part of why we have, not only in America, but in many parts of the world, what we can say obesity pandemic. I'm overweight myself. It's because some we have as many calories at our disposition as we want. And usually we eat far away more every single day without doing the work and the labor that will allow us to burn those calories. Therefore, how do we achieve a conscience that we need to be eating the right amount of calories, nonetheless? When at the same time, we have people in the same places that may be obesity, that we are having an issue with nutrients. People that are unhealthy, that they are overweight, but still they are not having enough vitamins, they are not having enough minerals, and all of a sudden creates all the sickness that we see later on in life, where if you take a look, America, for being the richest country in the history of mankind, the health cost of fixing Americans that they are unhealthy later in their lives is just astonishing. If we bring the whole of government, if we bring the whole of the private sector, if we bring the whole of organizations of faith, NGOs, all of a sudden, if we put all these mechanisms working together, we can transform the problem when then food becomes really the solution.
Well, and you talk about the whole of private sector approach there. I want to borrow on your experience as a restaurateur, because in many cases there's frankly some blame pointed at restaurants and chefs for perhaps preparing meals that could be a little bit bigger than they should be, a little bit more indulgent with the ingredients than they should be. I wonder your thoughts. What is the role of sort of the restaurateur and the restaurant sector in the broader health and nutrition conversation in the United States?
I think it takes a village to keep a country in the right way. I will agree with you that we've been always moving in the bigger portion size. And this obviously generates problems. It's many reasons why this happened. One is competition. Who gives you more, charging you less? This has been happening. That's the way of business in any business. Obviously, in food, can create certain problems. But at the end, goes a lot in a way to personal responsibility too. We cannot do better to be slightly healthier. We cannot just make the private sector or the government being the ones use almost like if they were our grandma. Hey, when I grew up, my grandma would always tell me, eat more. That was the old days. We all had that grandma and that mother. But the reality is today that this is the imbalance we have.
We'll be right back to discuss the work of World Central Kitchen and its response to Hurricane Ian with Chef Jose Andres right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. Hurricane Ian made landfall on Wednesday in Florida as a Category 4 hurricane. World Central Kitchen is one of the groups that will be aiding in the humanitarian response, and Chef Jose Andres says the group has learned quite a bit about how to do that in its more than one decade of service.
You know, the work of World Central Kitchen, and I think should be of any NGO, especially NGOs that work in emergencies, is to be next to the people, right? Next to the mayors of the small towns that they are badly affected by an earthquake or by a hurricane. We've seen these last days, last weeks, back-to-back hurricanes, Category 4s, almost 5, hitting parts of the Caribbean, parts of America and the Caribbean, like Puerto Rico, Florida. And I do believe it's very important to be there with food and water, because it's a lot of people that really suffer. And we try to create a system where we are there, not in a week, not in a month, right now. As we speak, we've already been in different parts south of Tampa, reaching every little town, contacting elderly homes, contacting the shelters where many families may be away from the destruction already of their homes in the coastlines. So I do believe that you need to adapt. You cannot have a plan. During this last Hurricane Ian, the teams of World Central Kitchen kept moving during days before the heat, because the hurricane kept moving. If we will leave the kitchens that we had north of Tampa, we will be far away from the main hurricane destruction happened. So, you know, it's very important also to always adapt. So we were doing this, and more important, at the very beginning, in the early days, it's impossible sometimes, even you prepare before, and you have all the food in the right places, so you have access and start cooking. But in Puerto Rico, for me, was a great joy. I was there just a few days before heading to Florida, that we were buying from local farms. World Central Kitchen, after Maria, invested through grants in more than 220 farms in Puerto Rico, making sure that we help Puerto Rico import less quantity of foods from outside the island. I think everybody will agree with me that if they can produce romaine and other fruits and vegetables in the island, why they need to bring it from the other side of the world? Doesn't make any sense. So for me, it was amazing to see that those farms that they are trying to achieve these, we were able to be selling World Central Kitchen fresh fruits and vegetables that we were at the same time giving to the people that were affected by the Hurricane Fiona. So you see, it's not only helping the people that may need a plate of food. But in the process, is keeping the economy running so the farmers can keep making an income. If we activate restaurants, the restaurants can still keep making an income. And this is a great way to have an emergency response where in the process of solving the problem, you are also beginning to invest into the reconstruction.
Mm-hmm. As you go through the process of offering aid around the world, as you have with World Central Kitchen, wondering when you get on the ground to have these conversations, to do these setups, to feed these meals and help these people, what is often the biggest challenge that you face throughout the process of, you know, not just from the process from ingredient procurement to, you know, cooking to final meal? What has been the biggest challenge that you and your team have had to overcome?
It's never two emergencies that they are alike. But it's always challenges. Usually it's the distribution challenge. How do we get the things we need when the entire infrastructure is broken and there's no electricity or is damaged bridges or generators that we, electricity goes away and the generators we had prepared, all of a sudden something happened to them, a tree falls on top, or who knows, we are too close to the hurricane and the wind blows it away. This could happen. Or we may be in an island that the kitchen we thought we were going to use is totally wiped out by the hurricane because the water went up 5 or 10 meters, covering the entire hotel and kitchen we were planning to use, and we have to adapt. All of a sudden, we'll need to have helicopters or seaplanes. Sometimes in Dominican Republic, we were delivering into mountains with the help of horses. The challenges are something like you can never prepare for, because as I said, we don't follow a plan. We only have a mission. The mission is bring food and water after emergencies as fast as quick as to many people that need it. And then with this very simple thing in mind, all the challenges we face become opportunities used to be creative and used to go around them. No matter what, the men and women of World Central Kitchen always seem to find a way. It's always food. It's always a place where we can cook. It's always more important people willing to cook and people willing to go on the road to find community by community that needs our help. And they know once we reach them and we contact them that we're not going to leave them alone until days or weeks later, things start going back to normal.
Last question for you here, Chef. I know you've been around the world seeing the various food systems throughout the globe. Wonder, and I know this is a big question, a big concept, but I wonder, how does the way that America cares for its hungry and its needy compare to around the world? How does it stack up?
Well, America is a very big place, and the problem is complex. We have... I've been in places in Asia, Indonesia, I've been in so many different places, Spain, Europe. The problem of homelessness is one. It's complicated, sometimes has a lot to do with mental health, but sometimes has to do with plain economy, people that lose their job and they are not able to move up. I don't think in many ways America is any different than what happens in other countries, for the good or for the bad. But what we cannot have is this, that we have in America today, families, children that go to bed hungry. This is something like it's highly solvable. We need to create breakfast and a school lunch that is universal. We need to make sure that the way we feed our children in the schools is a way to create ecosystems of food in every rural or a school system in America. I think schools is very smart. Not only for education, but making sure every children and why not every family has access to food, employing people that are trained to be cooks, those schools producing food from scratch with kitchens that they've been built, investing in infrastructure, creating further economic growth with the jobs that infrastructure investment creates, making sure we buy from more local farmers around the school systems, that then with that federal dollar that goes to feed children, all of a sudden, we can be impacting the whole economy, not only feeding the children, but all of a sudden raising those small farms across America that sometimes feel forgotten, that many of those farmers have a hard time to make ends meet at the end of every month. And all of a sudden, every dollar to feed the children is just impacting different parts of the economy. We need to see more models like this, more more opportunities to solve the problems like this. And then maybe then one day we can claim that everybody in America is eating, everybody in the world is eating. And in the process, everybody is just making it on their own.
Well, Chef, I've got about a dozen more questions, but we are unfortunately out of time. And so for now, I'll just say I'm looking forward to our next conversation, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel talks about obesity statistics across the country in this week's Map It Out.
As policymakers and private sector leaders gather to discuss hunger challenges this week, a matter of making sure the food people consume is nutritious was also top of mind. Obesity is a common and serious chronic disease of adults and children that continues to increase in the United States. Many factors can contribute to obesity, including eating patterns, physical activity levels, sleep routines, and genetics. The CDC says obesity costs the U.S. healthcare system $173 billion per year. This map from the CDC shows the prevalence of self-reported obesity among adults across the country. In every state, at least 20% of adults are obese. CDC's figures tell us Black and Hispanic adults had a higher obesity prevalence across the country than white adults. Overall, men and women of all races with college degrees had a lower chance of being obese compared to those with lower education. Obesity can lead to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and some cancers. According to the CDC, obesity also triples the risk of hospitalization from COVID-19. This week, the White House unveiled a strategy to end hunger and improve physical activity. Among other things, that plan calls for expanding access to obesity counseling and promoting the physical activity guidelines for Americans. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together, we celebrate together, but we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
At Clean Fuels Alliance America, we're working toward a future of clean energy now that will make our members proud. We serve as the clean fuels industry's primary organization for technical, environmental, and quality assurance programs, and are the strongest voice for its advocacy, communications, and market development. With industry-leading programs and incentives, Clean Fuels Alliance America is actively moving the clean fuels industry forward toward a brighter future.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're excited to continue our conversation about nutrition with this week's panel. Joined this week by Marshall Matz with OFW Law, Molly Van Loo with the International Fresh Produce Association, and Vince Hall with Feeding America. Appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Marshall, I want to go to you first, because the 1969 conference that the White House held on hunger issues is a legacy event. A lot of people that work in the food and nutrition space in Washington speak very frequently and very fondly of that event, frankly. And the post-event actions that took place in the administration on Capitol Hill. In your mind, what does the follow-up to this event need to look like to match the legacy of that conference?
Well, let's just start with the legacy first of the last conference. It's widely seen as successful really because of what the Congress did in the 70s. We took food stamps, I say we, it's the royal we, to a nationwide program, eliminated the purchase requirement. Believe it or not, you had to buy your food stamps before 1977. We created WIC, and not one person asked how much it was going to cost. School lunch was expanded, school breakfast was started. And then Dietary Goals for the United States was written in 1977. At the time, the American Medical Association really criticized us for practicing medicine without a license. But in 1980, USDA and HHS published the first edition of Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and they have republished it every 5 years since. I think the key to this conference and what happened yesterday, which was so exciting to see all these people who have been involved for so many years, is really what happens in the years ahead. The big difference is going to be, of course, the budget. In the 70s, it was before the Budget Act, before the budget committees, and no one asked how much a good idea was going to cost. We're going to be up against significant financial constraints. I think for that reason, there'll be a heavy emphasis on nutrition and health. We saw that FDA issued a label this week on the definition of healthy. I think that will be the major focus. We're going to have to fill the gaps on the food programs. There's still too many people going hungry. The lines are too long at the food banks. But I anticipate that the heavy emphasis on this conference and the legacy will be diet and nutrition and health.
Well, and Molly, let's talk about some of the follow-up there that that Marshall just mentioned, because, of course, the follow-up to the last conference was so critical, and the White House released a plan this week with a long list of things that they would like to see as the follow-up to this event. Many of them are going to require the will of Congress, and some folks in Congress, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, expressing a little bit of frustration, maybe at a lack of consultation, maybe some opposition to the ideas that were presented in that strategy. In your opinion, what does the White House need to do, and can they do anything necessarily to overcome some of that opposition and pursue these goals?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that yesterday created a wonderful platform for stakeholders to come together, and the process leading up to it was a great platform for all the stakeholders to come together. Moving forward, as you said, it's going to take congressional action. And I do think, we've long done advocacy and will continue to do advocacy and drive for these changes. And I think when you go in and you talk to lawmakers about the actual policies and the outcomes we're looking for, it's not partisan at all. So we're really confident that moving forward, certainly that there were concerns. That, as you said, coming from Republicans going into this and yesterday, but there was, bipartisan presence there yesterday. And when you really get down to the policies and the issues, I absolutely think that the momentum is in the right direction, regardless of party.
Well, and Vince, bringing you into the fold here, because Feeding America has been under the spotlight of the national hunger issue really for decades now, but especially since the advent of the COVID-19 pandemic and a lot of the work that was done at Feeding America and its nationwide food banks as a result. Wondering what, as the folks at Feeding America kind of sifted through the White House strategy, the White House plan, what was your organization's biggest takeaway?
Well, the biggest takeaway is that hunger is a very severe problem in this country. It is affecting 34 million people by the latest USDA estimates. It is also a very solvable problem. I mean, the truth is that we produce enough agricultural bounty in this country to feed everybody in this country. We just throw away more food every day than is necessary to solve hunger. And so the White House has pulled together policy recommendations that help to close the gap between what people are able to afford and what people need in order to feed and nourish their children and elderly seniors that live in their homes. So this is a watershed moment. This is a chance to take 50 years worth of policy knowledge, evolution, and development and apply it to what we're going to achieve in the next 7 or 8 years to meet the president's goal of ending hunger by 2030. So as you indicated, Feeding America has been involved very extensively in this work for decades. But during the pandemic, those miles-long lines of cars were vivid reminders of the fact that Feeding America food banks, the last rung on the ladder, the last protection against abject poverty, malnutrition, and hunger, are being stressed to the limit. And we simply have to act on many of the recommendations in this report as quickly as possible, because food banks are running out of food.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back. This week's White House strategy to address hunger and potentially end it by 2030 contains a long list of ideas to address the issue. Molly Vandeleu with the International Fresh Produce Association says some of those ideas could take pressure off the 2023 Farm Bill and future pieces of legislation.
So I definitely see there was fruit and vegetable incentives in SNAP, which was part of our recommendation. And we are glad to see that there would be a focus on improving fruit and vegetable access, because we still have a long way to go with incentives to make sure that every SNAP consumer has access to that. But we were really excited to see the inclusion of the produce prescription language and shifting it into the healthcare system and calling out CMS, because the resources are finite within the Farm Bill. We're not naive about that. There's some really great language in there already about produce prescriptions, and we're getting good data around that. But what we really want to see is shifting this into healthcare, which was an overall theme, I think, as Marsh referenced yesterday. So if we can start to shift some of this conversation on access by embedding it into healthcare, I think that takes some of the pressure off of the Farm Bill. SNAP is hugely important for access issues and dietary quality issues, but we put so much pressure on SNAP to kind of solve a lot of our healthcare problems when we believe that it's going to require more than that. And until you embed it into the healthcare system and treat fruits and vegetables and healthy foods as the preventative and treatment tools that they are, we're going to continue to have challenges. So we were really excited to see that in the blueprint yesterday, and are excited to kind of use that message as we go forth with Farm Bill, doing what we can within Farm Bill, but also understanding that this is so much bigger than one piece of legislation.
Well, and Marshall, one of the things that President Biden said at the event this week was that he feels that ending hunger in the United States by 2030 is a solvable problem and something that's within the grasp of the United States. In your opinion, what needs to happen for that goal to be achieved?
Well, let me just give you one suggestion that I did throw out to White House staff. They are looking for big, bold ideas. I have this idea that's been playing around in my head about using the IRS to collect school lunch fees once a year as part of your taxes and get schools out of the habit or out of the business of having to check income, collect income data. The schools keep hiring nutritionists, which we're being told to do. But then the nutritionists have to spend, there are 100,000 schools in the school lunch program, and there are 50 million kids in school. About 30 million of those 50 million participate in school lunch. But yet the school lunch authorities have to collect all the income data, verify income data, just like the IRS does. I don't understand why we can't do a bold restructuring of child nutrition, feed everybody without cost and without any discrimination at the point of service. But yet my kids, I would still pay for the school lunch once a year through the IRS. They know how many kids I have. They know our income. And I think we have to think out of the box a little bit in order to solve it. What we're doing isn't working. The food bank lines are getting longer, as was noted. And that is just a terrible situation. So I think we can do it. But if we are going to do it, we have to think boldly and think about these programs in a different sort of way.
Vince, I want to wrap up our dialogue with you here today, because we've on this panel spent a lot of time talking about futuristic goals, futuristic plans, and futuristic ideas. But I want to talk about the here and now with you, because in an earlier conversation that you and I had earlier this year, you said in the ballpark of about 30% to 40% of the food in some Feeding America food banks is actually being purchased rather than donated by the food banks. Can you catch us up on where things stand today? Is that still a lingering issue? Is it still a similar percentage that is being faced by Feeding America's food banks?
That is very much still a continuing crisis. You know, we have seen, because of disruptions in the food supply chain, reduced donations of food. We've also seen a reduction in the amount of philanthropic giving to food banks, which means they have less purchasing power. We're seeing higher prices, of course. And when we enter the market as food purchasers, we're competing against every other food purchaser for every truckload. And we're seeing sustained and increasing demand that in some places is at the same heights that it was during the height of the pandemic. So the reliance on purchased food at a time of declining donations means that many food banks are burning through reserves, and that is not a sustainable fiscal model. So something's going to have to change, and it's going to have to change very quickly.
Well, very good. A number of things to keep an eye on in the national hunger conversation, and that's a conversation that certainly took an interesting turn with a lot of new developments here this week. And folks, we appreciate you stopping by to join them to discuss us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pegel reports on something to watch in the international fertilizer markets in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
The future of the deal that opened grain exports from three ports in Ukraine is being threatened by Russia because of frustration over fertilizer exports. When Ukraine, Turkey, the United Nations, and Russia signed the deal, they also signed a separate deal, allowing an unrestricted flow of Russian fertilizer and wheat exports. Russian President Vladimir Putin says that deal is being blocked by logistics, European Union sanctions, and other barriers. Fertilizer is a key input for farmers around the world, and the absence of Russian supplies on the market is increasing prices. This chart shows fertilizer expenses for U.S. producers from 2013 to the projected totals in 2022. You can see the 2022 estimate for fertilizer expenses is just under $45 billion, which is a big jump over the average of the previous decade. United Nations officials are working to get Russian fertilizer on the market and make sure the global fertilizer shortage doesn't evolve into a global food shortage. Bill Thompson has a more comprehensive look at the issue in his story on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The Supreme Court will kick off its new term on Monday by hearing arguments over wetland regulations and the Clean Water Act. Virginia Tech will release their Global Agricultural Productivity Report on Tuesday. And this year's World Dairy Expo will be held Sunday through Friday in Madison, Wisconsin. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.